My name is Farah, and I'm black.
My name is Brad, and I'm white. And we've been married since 2006. But 40 years before that, couples like us who wanted to get married might not have been able to, because interracial marriage was still outlawed in parts of the United States.
In 1967, the Supreme Court ruled that laws prohibiting marriage between people of different races were unconstitutional. The ruling came in a case called Loving v. Virginia, which was named for Mildred and Richard Loving, a black woman and a white man, who were jailed and then forced to leave their home state of Virginia after marrying.
2017 marks the 50th anniversary of that court decision, and we wanted to commemorate the occasion by looking at what it's like to be in an interracial marriage at this moment in time. So we decided to spend a year interviewing interracial married couples and sharing their stories in this podcast.
This is the last regularly scheduled episode of The Loving Project, and we wanted to reflect a little bit on what we've learned this year by featuring some of our favorite moments from those interviews.
The 25 couples we've featured on the show all have some things in common. They're part of multiracial families. We did all of our interviews in person, so everyone we spoke to lives in or around the Philadelphia region. And of course, they all agree to be on a podcast talking about interracial marriage, so they're comfortable talking about race.
They definitely aren't a statistically representative sample of interracial couples across the U.S. But even though their stories are each unique, we did find some common themes that came up again and again.
For the most part, people we interviewed had families that accepted their relationships, but there were a few exceptions. For example, there's Florence and Ed from episode 12. They both grew up in the South and met in the 1960s. Ed is white, and Florence is African-American. Her family accepted Ed pretty quickly, but his family was a different story. When Ed went to visit his parents and tell them about their engagement, his mother wanted to speak with Florence.
So I got on the phone with his mother. She was calm enough at the beginning, but she worked herself into quite a frenzy. Very fundamentalist type of mindset. The kind of thing birds and fish don't mate.
And if you loved him, you would let him go.
Yeah, she did say that.
Yeah. I don't forget those conversations either, as hard and difficult as they were.
So they didn't come to our wedding. No one from his family came to our wedding. All of the guys, there were five bridesmaids, I think, and all of the groomsmen were members of my family or friends or whatever. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't until 6 years later that we visited them for the first time.
That was 5 decades ago. But while studies show that Americans are generally more accepting of family members dating and marrying someone of different races these days, still not all families approve. Melissa and Michelle from episode 11 have been together for more than 10 years. Michelle is black and grew up in a part of Philadelphia with a reputation for diversity. Melissa is white and grew up in a predominantly white Philadelphia neighborhood, one that has a reputation for racism.
There are still members of Melissa's family who I've gone to several events to who have never spoken a single word to me. And there is a family event that happens every Christmas that everyone goes to that I've been told explicitly that I am not allowed to attend. Not that I'm like chomping at the bit to like get to these events, but the simple fact that someone says to me, you can't come because you're black and it's 2017, you know, like that's bonkers to me.
Yeah. And so what that means is that I do not attend because I just don't understand why I can go, why I'm invited somewhere, but where my partner is not invited, mm-hmm. right? It doesn't feel necessary to have family members who are quite frankly racist against my partner, that they're completely closed off and don't even acknowledge her presence. So I'd rather just say that relationship is over.
It's sad to me because the family that I talk to that I love, I couldn't imagine my life without. And it's sad to me that you can't be around certain people because of our relationship.
One of the more dramatic stories we heard wasn't about a white family disapproving of someone dating a person of color. It was about Indian American parents who disapproved of their son dating a white woman. In episode 3, Carrie tells us about the first time she visited Arun's family after they began dating seriously.
He wasn't living at his parents' house, but we went over there Saturday afternoon.
You know, I have to do this justice. I had staged it.
When we went back and...
Because I had my cousin's mom was there. And she was one of the only Indians in our family who was really open-minded.
But when we went the first time, she wasn't there,
No, she was there. And that's the reason... Because we got kicked out like 20 minutes later. Like, so it all was like... Boom. Oh, explosion. My dad said,
I remember that she was there.
Leave and don't come back.
Yeah, you know, we went into another room. Arun's dad called him out of the room, came back a few minutes and said, he had basically said, don't come back with her.
Arun's parents did eventually come around, but it took several years before they were willing to accept Carrie and Arun's relationship.
We also heard from couples who were worried about how their partner's family would react when they found out about an interracial relationship. But sometimes those fears turned out to be unfounded. In episode 6, we heard from Beth and Helena. Beth is white and Helena's black.
I wasn't concerned about my family's reaction. I was more concerned about Beth's family's reaction. And I remember the first time meeting her parents, I kept saying to Beth, are you sure that they remember that I'm black? Are you sure? And she said yes. And the first time I met her dad, I walked into her apartment. And the first thing he looks at me and he says, oh my God, she's black. And then I just cracked up laughing. And he's such a jokester. And it was such a great icebreaker. And it was just a sweet, sweet moment to get over the fear of whether or not they would be accepting of me as a black woman.
Once he decided to make that joke, he couldn't wait for the opportunity. And he didn't tell me that until afterwards. I didn't know that that's what he was going to do. But yeah, because Helena regularly would ask me like, okay, so your parents know that I'm black, right? And I was like, yes. Did you specifically tell them? And I was like, do you want me to specifically tell? Yes, specifically tell them. I'm like, okay, I will make the announcement on our next phone call. And they were like, okay, but is she nice to you?
Family is one thing. The community might be another. Florence and Ed from episode 12 told us what it was like dating in the 1960s in the South.
We went to see Guess Who's Coming to Dinner. And came out of it, and there were a small group of little old white ladies who wanted us to know that situation that was happening, it was never happening in their house. That was just not, you know. And were there moments that were scary? Yeah, there were some moments that were scary. Driving, I can't remember where we were driving from.
St. Louis.
That might have been it.
Through Indiana?
Through Indiana. Mm-hmm. And there was a truck or a car following us.
They had a truck with a cab with a gun rack with rifles in it. And they had their window down, and they would do up and back on the expressway, up and back. So the driver of the car would know they're paying real close attention to everybody that's in that car. And they knew one of them didn't belong.
We completed that trip. And what I didn't know for years later was that Ed went out and bought a gun. And he carried that gun in the glove compartment of the car whenever we were traveling. That said to me that we weren't just talking about people saying mean things or making a scene, but that there was a very real and visceral danger that he had perceived. And while, you know, absolutely, I said, well, we're not doing guns. We're just not going to live like that. There was a part of me that was really glad that for those years when we were traveling on the road, that was available to us. Because clearly, I mean, the world was not looking at us and saying, oh, what a great couple. So yeah, there were definitely scary moments. Mm-hmm.
While a lot has changed since the 1960s, there are still people who disapprove of interracial couples today, and who are willing to voice those opinions publicly. In episode 4, we met Courtney and Dave. Courtney is black and Dave is white. And Courtney remembers how it felt to be out in public when they first started dating in 2005.
I remember one of the first times Dave and I were walking, holding hands, and my heckles were up just because I was just like waiting. Because it was the first time I had like a white boyfriend. And I just didn't want anyone to say anything. Like, I was walking in a way like, I dare you. Please try it. When we were living at a different, were we living here over on Cedar? We were walking to the farmer's market, holding hands, and this guy was pumping his gas by that gas station. And he goes, what are you doing with that white trash? It was kind of one of those things, it's like, you know, first of all, who are you? Second of all, why do you think that you can actually, like, I don't know you. Why are you talking to me? And then why are you insulting my boyfriend? Just because we are of the same color doesn't mean that you get to speak to me, first of all. Second of all, it doesn't mean that you get to talk crazy. I was just so mad and just so frustrated because it's like, who do you think you are?
One thing we heard from a lot of people was how being in an interracial marriage changed the way they think about race relations in America. For example, here's Jonathan from episode 9. He's a white man married to an Indian woman named Arthi. He was working as a reporter for a newspaper in Chicago when they met.
Overall, I was pretty insensitive to the realities of racism at a personal level until I met Arthi. So I kind of went into it like, well, you know, it's America, it's 20 whatever, it's everything's gonna be fine. You know, what's the big deal? Racism's over, right? It's not that I didn't know. I was actually acutely aware at that point in my career about anti-Black racism because I was working covering courts and crime in Chicago, and you can't do that work without coming to a very deep and kind of visceral understanding about institutional racism towards the Black community. But that's different than knowing that when you tell your grandmother that you're dating an Indian woman, she would explain to you that the Indian people are really Caucasian and that they shouldn't refer to themselves as not Caucasian because they're from the Caucasus region. That's what Caucasian means.
I forgot that she did that.
Yeah, she was not excited about me dating Arthi, and it definitely was about her race. And to her deep credit, it took like a month for her to come around. I mean, she kind of met Arthi once, and she couldn't help herself. She fell in love with Arthi too, and pretty quickly she started referring to Arthi as my granddaughter.
Yeah.
You know, it's a story where everything comes out great in the end, but it was there. It was there in some ways that I did not expect. And then for me, it was just this, as we dated and got closer and then got married, like, you know, it was just this continual education for me that the world saw her differently, or at least a lot of white Americans saw her differently. And so that was, it was hard.
And in episode 23, we heard from Joshua and Marlene. Joshua is white and Marlene is Black and Dominican. She says their relationship gave her a new appreciation for how different people think or don't think about race on a daily basis.
Growing with Joshua and living with Joshua, especially the first few years when we were getting to know each other more, I could see how it's much easier to not think about race if you're white. And it doesn't make you a bad person. But I saw how it was much easier. Like, Joshua, you could go your whole day without thinking about race. If you did that, it would not negatively affect your day. You could still get everything that you needed to get done and have a good day. You could have a good day. And so that's one thing that I've, that level of understanding, which I think is important if we are to have dialogues. We all need to talk about race, all of us, white people, Black people, Asian people, Latino people, like we all need to talk about race. And not all of us are doing it. And I think it's easier for certain people, like white people, to not do it. Now, understanding and seeing why it's easier for them to not think about it, I think I'm a little bit more patient, but we still need to talk about it.
In episode 8, we hear from Simeon and Anastasia. Simeon is Black and Anastasia is white. And she told us about a time when they took their children to a playground and realized that they have different approaches towards navigating unfamiliar spaces.
So we're in the suburb playground, which are super nice, great playgrounds. I wanted to take the kids to ride their bikes on a tennis court because they're just learning how to ride and it's nice and flat. We get there. I never would have read the sign. My kids can ride their bikes on an empty tennis court. No one's there. My husband's like, the sign says you can't ride bikes on the tennis court. And I was like, you're ridiculous. They should be able to go. And then he totally shut me down. What did you say?
I said, this is white privilege. I mean, I don't really talk about it, but I said, you could argue this is textbook.
You said, this is how you are. You just go and do whatever you want.
I said, sometimes, yeah, you go and you can just do whatever you want.
This isn't my neighborhood. I don't know anybody here. I don't know these people. And the minute he said that, I just felt all kinds of guilt. I felt horrible. And it sucked.
Yeah. What I would try to say is, see, when I walk into a neighborhood, I immediately have to know my surroundings and I stand out. So naturally, I'm going to read the sign. Okay, what's the deal here? It's likely nothing was going to happen, but I don't want to be in a situation where like someone, the neighbor comes out or someone says something and my kids have to like see that.
I never thought about it.
Yeah.
I was like, this is ridiculous. They're children.
Or there was the time when Kate and Courtney from episode 18 were driving to upstate New York to visit Kate's grandmother. Kate is white and Courtney is black. They got pulled over for speeding and had very different reactions to their experience with the police officer.
You know, I think the cop sees a not great looking car with out of state license plates and a black person, a white person in the car. And he, I think, you know, compared to the times that I've been pulled over alone, the presumption was this is something much bigger than a speeding ticket. Whereas when I've gotten pulled over alone, it's like, you're speeding, what's going on? And just the level of tension and fear and just how intense it was just really noticeable. And when it was over and we're pulling away, you know, I'm kind of shaking a little bit. And Courtney says, wow, this was like the most chill interaction I've had with a cop. And I'm like, this is the least chill interaction I've had with a cop.
Yeah, I was like, woo, that was it. And she was like, no, that was really tense. I was like, really? You know, because that to me is just, you know, every, like other times when I've had interactions with police, you know, have not been that chill. I mean, I was like, he seemed pretty calm to me, calm as far as police interactions go.
There are also times when a topic comes up in conversation and it becomes clear that one partner's experience of the world is very different from another's. David and Eric touched on this in episode 15. David is white and Eric is black.
Even the process of like getting a first haircut for a white child is very different from a black child. Like me and both my brothers sobbed through our first haircuts because it's terrifying. There's a razor in your ear and this guy's like ripping a pick through your hair and it's like really unpleasant. And that's the thing with us. I think we walk blithely into these conversations and then you look around and you're like, all right, so black people's hair hurts. Apparently this is a space where I have some sensitivity and some damage. And like the thing you said before, it's not you, it's me, but also it's the world. And anyway, we should stop talking about this because I think I hate white people. I think I hate white people today. And so like one of the things that's so great about David is that I do talk about how much I hate white people a lot. And you always take that in stride. And I feel bad. But I also like there are times where I'm like, I am not pleased.
Yeah.
And I feel like, you know, that's not a like I don't, you know, why am I saying this on a broadcast? Now all the white people I know are going to be like, do you hate me? And I'll be like, a little bit. But not really. You understand right. When I say that. And we talk a lot about systems. And I think that's like sort of the shorthand. I'm not talking about individual white people. I'm talking about white systems of oppression and of privilege. But that's got to be hard to hear.
Well, it's interesting, though, because it's not hard for me to hear because I feel for me, being Presbyterian, like our view of humanity is not great. Mm-hmm. Like people are not particularly wonderful. Mm-hmm. Like, we have the ability to learn grace and we have the ability to be transformed. But like our natural state, like in my tradition, is like people are kind of horrible. So I think when there are these moments where you're like, oh, I like this is so awful. And I really hate white people in this moment. For me, I'm like, yeah, like my whole education is like, let's learn all the ways. And so I think for me in those moments, when we have those conversations, that's like par for the course.
Yeah.
Sometimes one partner in an interracial couple might find themselves wondering if they can ever really know the other person. In episode 23, Marlene talks about finding herself in that position in the aftermath of the 2016 presidential election. Marlene is black and her husband Joshua is white.
The day after the election, when the polls started to come through and the breakdown of, you know, who voted for Trump, I was really, really, really distraught and I hadn't slept. We had stayed up really late. So I wasn't in my right mind, but for a moment, I questioned who Joshua voted for. And I turned to him and I said, did you vote for Trump? It was kind of a ridiculous question. And I realized that, but I was in tears when I asked him. I was so upset. I couldn't believe it. And in my mind, I kept asking, you know, what person that I thought wasn't going to vote for Trump voted for Trump? And am I married to that person? That was a really low moment for me. I know you didn't. And I wasn't even thinking straight. I felt betrayed. And at that moment, it was so low, I suspected someone who I know would never do that when I'm in my right mind.
Well, we both found out that there are people that had friendly relationships with who we didn't think would vote for a virulently racist and misogynistic presidential candidate. And it turns out that somehow they did.
True. So it wasn't, I wasn't coming totally out of left field, but.
It was statistically justified because a whole bunch of white people did vote for Trump, but I was probably the wrong person to suspect.
you were the first white person I saw that day.
Sure.
I'm sorry.
Apology accepted.
Interracial couples with biracial children often have to deal with situations that other parents might not have to face. We've heard stories from Black mothers who were mistaken for the nanny of their own light-skinned child, and of white parents who have had to learn to talk to their brown-skinned children about potential police abuses. Sometimes people don't even realize that a multiracial family is a family, as Jennifer and Sean from episode 19 discovered. Jennifer is white, and Sean is Black, and their 2-year-old son Wyatt has light skin and curly blonde hair.
We had an incident where Sean went into daycare to pick Wyatt up, and they handed over a little girl who was African American. And he said, "No, that's not my child. Wyatt's my child."
In their defense, they had a stand-in who was in, and there were only 2 kids left. She didn't hand the child to me. She said, "Oh, you're here for the princess." And I was like, "No, I'm here for the prince."
Sometimes people just jump to the wrong conclusions. Carrie from episode 3 remembers a time when she took her kids to the dentist. Carrie's white and her husband is Indian with brown skin.
I was in the dentist office a couple of years ago and it was August. And so the kids, of course, their skin is tan and it gets very tan in the summer. They get, you know, and I slather them with sunscreen, but it doesn't matter. This is really funny, actually. I was sitting with the kids in the dentist office, and there was a woman, a white woman, who was doing that, like, I know she's staring at me, but she doesn't want me to know kind of thing. And the kids go back to see the dentist, and I was waiting in the waiting room, and she looked at me, and she said, "Oh, I don't know if I should say something," which is usually an indicator that you shouldn't. You should just stop talking. And she said, "You know, I have to tell you that your children are entirely too tan." And I just thought, like, and I sort of just looked at her downfounded and was like, "Their father is Indian."
That's a story Carrie finds funny, but sometimes people's remarks to parents of biracial children can be hurtful. In episode 21, we heard from Kevin and Lisa. Kevin is Korean-American, and Lisa is white. They have 2 children, and Lisa recalls what happened when she started going out in public with their first daughter.
I would take Lillian to the mall, and a lot of people assumed that she was adopted, because I was there by myself. And interestingly enough, it was Asian women that said to me, "When did you get her?" But for me, it was my daughter. She was my daughter. I gave birth to her. She was a part of Kevin and me. And it was very hurtful. It was very hurtful, that assumption. I had all the best comebacks with the next daughter, and no one has ever asked me if she was adopted. Lillian looked very Asian when she was born. The discharge nurse actually asked me, "Are you sure this is your child?" And I said, "I'm positive this is my child. My husband will be right back."
Raising biracial children is even more complicated in the age of Black Lives Matter, when parents have to have conversations with their children about shootings of Black people by the police in this country. Beth and Helena from episode 6 have 4 children. Helena's Black and Beth is white. They chose male donors who would help them have biracial children, so all of their children look like they're part of the same family. Helena says they started talking seriously to their children about race and race relations in America after police in Cleveland, Ohio, shot and killed Tamir Rice, a 12-year-old Black child, in 2014.
And that's when we had to have the hard conversation of, even though you are a mixed race child, when you walk out into the street, you're going to be seen as a Black child, and you need to know that you can't play with guns on the playground, play guns, water guns. You can't do that. And there are things that you have to do as a Black child that you wouldn't have to do as a white child. You can't get away with certain things. We had that hard conversation, and we continue to have that conversation.
I feel like we waited because it felt like stealing their innocence a little bit. Mm-hmm. But then, yeah, when Tamir Rice was shot, it was like, we can't wait any longer.
Yeah.
And we repeatedly have the conversation, I do at least a lot more with our 8-year-old. When he started learning about the civil rights movement last year, he'd come home and he'd be like, "Mama, people that looked like you were really mean to people that looked like me." And I was like, "You are correct. Do you want to talk about that?" You know, and we would have some really hard and, you know, just sort of sad conversations. And I feel like I try to be really honest with him. And when he asks, like, why did that happen? We talk about how people have, sometimes hate in their heart and do really cruel things to other people who are their equals and don't treat people like their equals. And it's always really depressing. And it is a regular conversation that we have to have.
Well, these are the sorts of conversations Black parents have been having with their children for a very long time. It's a lot to process for white parents of brown children, and it's easy to find overwhelming. In episode 4, Dave, who is white, and Courtney, who's Black, talked about how they worry about their 18-month-old son, Desi.
The whole Black Lives Matter thing, that was a whole new eye-opening thing with having Desi, and it was just like, man, there's this stuff that could happen to Desi when he starts learning how to drive. And it's just like, man, it's the stuff that she had been dealing with for her whole life, I guess, and it just weighs down on me now. It's like, whoa. And I saw like media stuff, and this is when he was little, I guess, but there was points where I was just like, I didn't know what to do. Like, I didn't know how to react to it, and I would just like cry sometimes about it.
And in episode 9, Jonathan, who is a white man married to an Indian woman with brown skin, talks about his fears about the world their 6-year-old son Eli is growing up in.
Eli is such a beautiful boy. He's such a little ray of light. He is so full of love for people. It's really uncanny. He cares so deeply about people being happy. Strangers, family members, all he ever wants for them is to experience love and joy. He talks all the time about how he just wishes that Grammy and Grandpa could be here all the time so that all the family can always be all together all the time, because he just wants that. And yet he's going to grow bigger, I think. And, you know, he's rambunctious because he's full of joy. He's going to be horsing around on the street someday, and some cop is going to see him and think there's a Latino boy who's causing trouble. And I worry about him getting shot. I mean, I worry about him getting shot by some freaked out cop who sees a brown kid doing something that cop thinks a kid shouldn't be doing. He's not going to know that Eli is half white and half Indian and has two respectable parents. Not that that should matter if he does or doesn't. He's just going to see a brown kid and freak out. I don't know that that's going to happen, but Jesus, it happens all the time. So why wouldn't it?
In some situations, interracial couples have learned to navigate the world in new ways together. For example, in episode 26, we heard from Ermias and Jen. Ermias is Black and Eritrean, and Jen is white and American. They have two children, and Jen says she knows sometimes people don't assume they're all part of the same family. So there's at least one situation where she takes extra steps to let people know that they're together.
When we're traveling, airports make me very anxious. And that's why when we go through airports, I want to hold all the passports, especially if we're traveling internationally, especially if we're in a foreign airport, because I want to indicate, like, this is my family, because I'm scared he's going to get separated out, or he and the kids are. And we've never had that experience, but I always sort of feel like we need to do something to indicate by handing the passports as a group that we are a unit, because that's such a place where you can be treated so differently with such repercussions. And he doesn't like it. He tries to take his passport away because he wants to be independent.
Take your passport
and leave me with the children. But yeah, no, I feel like it's just simpler. And I think people do look at you differently. And it does streamline things. I don't often have issues in airports. And other people do, as a matter of course, because of the way they look or because of their name looks funny. And I've heard lots of stories of other people who have had problems in airports who don't look like me. So I am the one who grabs the passports and hands them over as a unit in order to sort of indicate that we're a family together.
And in episode 7, Donna and Craig told us that there are some things that are easier for Craig to do because he's white and Donna's Black.
There were certain things, like back when we were in Manhattan, and it's like, you know, I'm the guy who goes and gets the cab. She stays back on the sidewalk. You know, so you learn certain things.
Mm-hmm. He learned a lot that way. Yeah. It's like, okay, you get the cab.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and when we were looking for a house, it's like, maybe you should walk through the door first. And things, you know, that I'm just a lot more sensitive to. And he would give me a look like, what is wrong with you? And be like, just do it. So he would be more successful at getting cabs and things like that. And I think you got a little dose of what it's like to be a Black person through that experience, you know, mm-hmm. even just having to think about that, which is not something you would normally think about.
No.
As a white dude.
It's not.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And it's a little tricky, you know, because on the one hand, you want to be true to yourself and your culture. And on the other hand, you realize that he's going to get the cabs to stop for him. Mm-hmm. And if we're in New York City and we want to get uptown, I'm going to put him out there like, get go, get the cab. Does that make me feel good? No, not at all.
One of the interesting things about talking to people about the 50th anniversary of Loving v. Virginia in 2017 is that these interviews came just a few years after another important Supreme Court decision related to marriage and civil rights. In 2015, the court issued its ruling in the case of Obergefell versus Hodges, making same-sex marriage legal across the United States. Many of the people we spoke to saw parallels between the recent fight for marriage equality and the Supreme Court ruling that struck down anti-miscegenation laws prohibiting interracial marriage 5 decades earlier. In episode 20, we heard from Len and Fernando. Len is white and Fernando is Chinese-Cuban. They've been together since 1981, and they raised a daughter together. But they only got married in 2014, after participating in the lawsuit that legalized same-sex marriage in Pennsylvania, a year before the Supreme Court decision. Len told us why it was important to him to fight for marriage equality.
I think it does have to do with the long history of just not being treated the same way as heterosexual couples, heterosexual people, and the feeling that there's something significant about being able to be on the same footing. I grew up in a time and a place where being gay was not a positive thing, wasn't talked about much actually, but when it was in negative terms. And so something about the right to do the same things that other people can do was important to me. But I think beyond that, for me anyway, it does signify a kind of permanence and long-term commitment that I may have felt before we got married, but it was a nice way to put it into sort of a form that other people could understand.
I think, though, that in the gay community, when marriage was being talked about as a right, there were two schools of thought in the LGBT community. One said that, why do we want to perpetuate this institution that is very patriarchal and it uses women as like objects? So why do we want to copy and paste that? And then the other school of thought is, as Len said, we should have the same rights as straight people, and the attendant rights and legal rights and tax rights and all those rights. And so why not?
Eric and David from episode 15 got married in 2016. David is white and Eric is black. He remembers how he felt when same-sex marriage became legal in Pennsylvania, before he and David had even started dating.
It was like a light went on in a room that I didn't realize was dark. Sort of like when you're sitting in a space and like it's getting close to evening and you look around, you're like, oh my gosh, it's actually darker in here than I thought. And you turn on the light and you're like, oh, I feel better. I didn't realize how uncomfortable I had been. I didn't realize how all of the things that I was primed to believe about myself, that I was worthy of love and marriage and family, were constantly being denied. So to have that affirmed, that I could conceivably get married, was amazing.
As a Presbyterian pastor, it was really important for me, and just as a lifelong Presbyterian, it was really important that I was able to get married in my church. And so the Presbyterian Church had approved marriage equality before the Supreme Court ruling. The Supreme Court ruling for me opened up as a pastor what I knew to be true, that God blessed all unions and that that was possible. And so for a lot of people, it was a celebration of a legal victory. And for me, it was this victory of God's love in the world. And so when we got engaged, there was just so much that felt true and possible and just this incredible victory of love in a way that was incredibly profound for me.
One of the best things about hearing these stories was hearing about the ways that people from different backgrounds viewed those differences as a strength rather than a weakness. Over and over, we heard about things that people learned from one another, how they expanded their horizons and created multiracial and multicultural families.
In the winter, we do Diwali, mm-hmm. and then we do Hanukkah, mm-hmm. and then we do Christmas.
Yeah, there's a lot.
There's a lot. And all of those are
really fun.
All those are festivals that are about lighting things in the dark. And it just means that there's three lighting things in the winter for us instead of just one lighting thing. And it's beautiful. It's really, it's beautiful.
You embrace the culture, and he tried the foods. I mean, there's still some things he won't eat, but he tried, for the majority, love the foods. He even likes, he loves Tanjungguk now, which is, I remember when you first tried it, you like just refused to even look at it. And now it's, loves that. He tried to learn Korean, which I think to my parents was a really big deal, that he was making this effort in eating the food, trying to learn the language, learning the cultures.
I remember the first time I went to Belinda's family Thanksgiving, and there was a turkey, there was a roast beef, there was a ham, there were greens.
Macaroni and cheese.
Macaroni and cheese.
Sweet potatoes.
There were sweet potatoes. You know, my jaw dropped. I just wasn't used to this. It was an eye-opener for me as far as how Black folks celebrate holidays. I mean, it still amazes me.
And part of that is, my mother used to save all of her food money. My grandmother did the same thing for holidays. Between September and November, you ate very austere because they were saving the money for the holidays. Because the holidays, everybody comes and you have a lot of food because people are taking home a plate. You know, even if you're not eating it, folks are taking home food. And I think that that harpens back to historically people coming together to share what it is they had and making sure that there was still some for people to take home so that they could enjoy it for the rest of the week. So it's a different way of experiencing how we are able to exist in the world. But that was not his experience.
At all.
At all.
At all.
At all.
That was Jonathan and Arthi from episode 9, Ken and me from episode 24, and David and Belinda from episode 22.
We'd like to thank all the couples who shared their stories with us over the past year. We'd also like to thank all the people that helped make this project a reality and a success, including Kathy and Al Green, Mary Galgan and Bill Russell, Alex Barnett, WHYY, and NPR.
You can find all the episodes of The Loving Project at our website, lovingproject.com. And the podcast is available on iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, NPR One, and just about anywhere else podcasts are found. This is the last regularly scheduled episode of The Loving Project podcast, but you can continue to keep in touch with us on social media. You can find links on our website, lovingproject.com. I'm Brad Linder.
And I'm Farrah Parks. Thanks for listening to The Loving Project.